May it please the court, my name is Susan Trin Almany. My attorney registration number is 26281. The single issue in this appeal today is whether the district court erroneously ruled that the UMDDA was not applicable to the defendant because he was on parole at the time he was charged in this matter. The AG have asserted a number of sub-issues, but we submit that none of these sub-issues are properly before this court because they were not raised in the district court below. However, we will address these issues for purposes of today's argument.
Now, counsel, let me just stop you on that point. I am aware that, generally speaking, an appellee, the prevailing party, may assert any argument in defense of the court's order, even if it wasn't relied on or even raised below. So what distinguishes your position here? Why can't they rely on these alternative grounds?
Well, because these are fact-specific grounds. For example, their first claim relates to substantial compliance of the with the UMDDA requirements. Now, here, substantial compliance basically requires that in this case, the pro se motion itself substantially complies to the extent that it tells the court that there is a UMDDA claim. In this case, when Mr. Jess appeared in court on December 19, 2006, the prosecutor did not raise any claim of substantial compliance, so that it is basically presumed that the prosecutor had no issues with the compliance shown in that pro se motion.
Why? Why do we presume that?
Well, I think substantial compliance ties in strongly with the actual notice issue. And for actual notice, the fact that the prosecutor did not raise that issue strongly indicates that
it supports an inference that the prosecution actually did.
Exactly, that they received actual notice.
Express surprise, but it clearly doesn't establish that point one way or the other. I mean, it's certainly a rebuttable inference.
Well, I would disagree. I think that the prosecutor, in not raising any claim of actual notice or substantial compliance, basically conceded to those two factors being met by the defendant's pro se motion. With a hearing in court on December 19th, the prosecutor certainly had an opportunity to at that time say, wait a minute, we never received notice of this motion. And besides the fact, even if we did receive this, it doesn't substantially comply. They never raised that. So, in effect, they conceded those two points on that date, December 19th. In any event, even if this court does not want to, doesn't want to give the prosecutor's silence that effect, from December 19th on, there was certainly actual notice, and any question of substantial compliance really goes to, was it clear enough? And and on December 19th, I think it became very clear that Mr. Jess unquestionably was invoking his UMDDA rights. Therefore, even if this court doesn't give Mr. Jess's motion effect on May 11th, 2006, there's no dispute that as of December 19th, 2006, there was substantial compliance, there was actual notice. So I think this court can set aside those two sub-issues of substantial compliance and actual notice. Then the third issue that the AG has raised is that of express waiver. Now, the people urge this court that a defendant can impliedly waive his UMDDA rights, despite the fact that the statute's plain language states that any waiver has to be expressed must be on the record, it must be made after advisement by the court. None of those things happened in this case. People v. Carr, of course, is the deciding case on this issue, and in that case, the Court of Appeals went through a very detailed analysis of the UMDDA, and quite frankly, it was a fairly straightforward analysis because the plain language of the UMDDA is very clear. It requires those three factors, and the other factual basis for the defendant's argument that there was no express waiver is, of course, as you go through the transcripts of those hearings starting on December 19th, at every single opportunity, at every single hearing, the defendant adamantly, clearly stated, I am not waiving my rights under the UMDDA. I know, judge, trial court judge, that you are saying it doesn't apply to me because I was on parole, but I am not waiving that. I believe it applies to me. He stated it over and over again in every hearing and through numerous, numerous motions.
Didn't he, or counsel on his behalf, make at least one request for a continuance?
He did.
How can you make a request for a continuance and simultaneously preserve your rights under the UMDDA?
Well, that actually is addressed in People v. Carr. And in People v. Carr, the court held that even if you request a continuance, that in itself cannot be considered an implied waiver. That for UMDDA rights to be waived, simply accepting a continuance is not sufficient, that the defendant must expressly waive his rights, and that must be done after an advisement by the court. So in that case, for example, or in Mr. Jess's case, for example, if at the time Mr. Jess's counsel had requested a continuance, and if at that point the trial court had advised Mr. Jess that in doing so, he would be waiving his UMDDA rights, so giving him the advisement, and then Mr. Jess said, yes, all right, I accept that on the record, then that is, and it is a waiver, a valid waiver pursuant to the UMDDA, according to People v. Carr in its read of the UMDDA statute. That didn't happen in Mr. Jess's case. In fact, it was on that very day that Mr. Jess said, yes, I accept a trial date, but I'm not waiving my UMDDA rights. And the district court specifically stated, quote, I am not going to find that you have waived your rights under the UMDDA. I am not going to find that you have knowingly and voluntarily waived your rights under that statute. So the district court itself acknowledged that there was no waiver by Mr. Jess throughout the course of these proceedings.
Counsel, it seems to me that the underlying question here is going to be the effect of the statutory amendment and the Carr decision, not on so much on the doctrine of implied waiver, which I agree with you has been dealt a body blow by those two authorities, but rather on this separate doctrine of tolling, which seems to be based not by analogy to the speedy trial statute, but rather on the text of 1614.1041. And I'm wondering whether it is possible to stand those two doctrines side by side and say, yes, there's been no waiver of the UMDDA rights, but that by requesting a continuance, the time was tolled under subsection 1 of that statute. Now, can you address that point?
Well, and I don't have the exact case law with me, but I know case law has stated that the UMDDA right to speedy disposition, although similar to speedy trial rights, is to be viewed very distinctly. And it is supposed to be viewed, construed very strictly. So that even though speedy trial rights may be told, There is no indication in any case law or statute that those UMDDA rights can be similarly told without a waiver. And of course, Carr states that that waiver must be expressed.
But if we find cases that where the court has contemplated the validity of a tolling concept in the UMDDA, then your argument is going to be weakened.
Yes, but I'm not aware of any such cases.
Okay.
So if this court then sets aside that express waiver sub-issue, then we really just come down to the simple question that is raised on this appeal, which is, of course, whether a defendant can invoke his UMDDA rights if he's on parole at the time of the charges. And the answer to that question is very simple. There's a line of case law that states that, indeed, a defendant is entitled to invoke UMDDA rights if he is on parole. And again, I'd like to stress that Mr. Jess would submit that his UMDDA request was effective as of May 11th, 2006. But even aside from that May 11th date, there's a certain almost indisputable argument that on December 19th, 2006, Mr. Jess asserted those rights in open court. There was no issue of substantial compliance, actual notice on that date. And so if we count from December 19th, 2006, then he should have gone to trial or had a disposition by June 17th, 2007. He didn't enter his guilty plea until August 2007, some 6 weeks later, so that the trial court was without jurisdiction to accept his guilty plea at that time. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
You have about 3 minutes, Ms. Almeny.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Clemmie Engel, and I'm representing the people in this appeal. At the outset, I have to disagree with counsel that the only issue in the case is whether the trial judge was wrong in ruling that the UMDDA doesn't apply to crimes committed after a prisoner's released on parole. I think in my brief, I've basically conceded the judge was wrong on that point. And I do think as appellee, I can raise any grounds supported by the record in defense of the judgment. So that's exactly what I'm doing. I readily admit that some of the points I've raised were not aired in the trial court. While I don't have much to add to my brief, I'd like to hit the highlights on three issues. First of all, was the purported request in this case sufficient under the doctrine of substantial compliance? Secondly, did the prosecutor receive actual notice? And then third, time permitting, what about People versus Carr? Now, first of all, consider the context in which this reported request was submitted. In early May of 2006, the defendant is sitting in the Denver County Jail. The public defender has been appointed to represent him in the Jefferson County case, our case here. So he is represented. His initial advisement in the Jefferson County case has been set for May 23rd. So on May 9th, the public defender files a petition for writ of habeas corpus ad prosequendum, asking the judge to order the defendant to be brought from Denver to Jefferson County for his advisement on May 23rd, and the trial court grants that the same day. Now, 2 days later, on May 11th, a pro se motion for writ of habeas corpus comes in. You've got it attached to my brief, and it has an order for transport form attached to it. At first glance, it just appears to duplicate what the public defender had just filed 2 days earlier. But if we look just within the four corners of this document, as I think we need to, This does not give fair notice that this prisoner intends to invoke the UMDDA. First of all, look at the title or the caption on the document. It's called Motion for Writ of Habeas Corpus. Certainly, that does not alert the reader to what is going to be coming in the fine print, and in fact, it can be argued that it's calculated to mislead. On the text of the first page, it does say, among other things, bring me before the court, and I quote, request speedy disposition, end quote. But if we look at People versus Campbell at head note 3, that tells us that that language is too indefinite to invoke the UMDDA because it could mean a lot of things. The next page on this document is blank order for transport. That doesn't tell us anything. The third page of this document is a homemade list called additional notices and requests. And among several notices and requests, the prisoner sneaks in a request for a speedy disposition, quote, per the UMDDA.
Well, Ms. Engel, I appreciate the characterization sneaks in, but if the judge read this, wouldn't the judge be on notice that, oh gosh, we've got a defendant here who's requesting relief under the UMDDA? I mean, that's what it says. And it may not be elegant, but we don't go on titles in much of anything, I don't think. And as an attachment to the motion, which requests a speedy disposition, doesn't this get the job done?
I think not. I think if you look at it as a whole, I don't think you can say it fairly alerts the reader. If you think otherwise, and the trial judge has to go through this thing with a fine-toothed comb, every pro se pleading that comes in, even where the defendant's represented, and presumably we're not supposed to, the trial court doesn't need to entertain hybrid pleadings. But even if you think I'm wrong on that, then so be it, and there are some other points I have.
Can I just stop you on that point? Because I really would appreciate some guidance on this. The statute it lists a few things that the request has to do. Are there cases that construe this statutory requirement and provide a little more guidance about what, to use your phrase, provides fair notice? I mean, is that phrase even part of the governing law here?
That's my phrase. The defense suggests that I'm basically inventing the requirement that the request has to be sufficiently clear in order to be adequate under this substantial compliance doctrine. Well, don't take my word for it. Let me point you to what the Colorado Supreme Court has to say, and this is the closest I can come to specific guidance. If you look at Campbell, it says that the request must not be, quote, too indefinite, end quote. And that's cited at page 26 of my brief. And Trancoso says, and this may be the best articulation, Trancoso says the request must make it, quote, sufficiently clear that the prisoner seeks to invoke the protections of the act, end quote. Now we could argue whether this particular request made it sufficiently clear. I submit that the Supreme Court did not have in mind a request that's buried in an addendum to a pleading whose caption bears no relation whatsoever to the UMDDA. And also bear in mind, when we talk about the doctrine of substantial compliance, that doesn't refer to a purported request that's worded in murky terms. Substantial compliance means that, as a matter of judicial construction, the court is going to let the defendant off the hook from going through the correct procedure. The correct procedure, he can't send this straight to the court. If he follows the statute, he's got to send it to the superintendent where he's housed. The superintendent then certifies what the conviction is, how much time is left. The superintendent sends this by registered mail to the court and the prosecutor, so there's a provable paper trail, and we don't have all these problems. In that regard, I'm also troubled by the fact that under the doctrine of substantial compliance, it echoes the first section of the statute that says the request has to reference the place of confinement. Well, in literal terms, this one did. The defendant said, I'm in the Denver County Jail. But I wonder if the doctrine of substantial compliance contemplates a situation where the defendant's in a county jail instead of in the Department of Corrections, because in this situation, the mere fact that he said, my place of confinement is the Denver County Jail, nothing in there fairly alerts the reader that he's in the custody of the Department of Corrections or that he's on parole so as to be subject to the act. So a reasonable judge getting this, even if the judge is reading UMDDA, the judge maybe is reading, well, this guy's just in the Denver County Jail. Maybe he's just in there, you know, they popped him because he was driving drunk. This guy hasn't shown me he falls under the UMDDA. So I think there are a lot of problems with this particular request. But even if we think, even if you think that that request was adequate, it didn't trigger the act unless and until the prosecutor had actual notice of it. And that didn't happen here, if it happened at all, until December 2006. Just as in the Mascarenhas case, there were several hearings between this purported request in May of 2006 and later in December 2006, and at none of those hearings did the defendant nor defense counsel invoke or even mention the UMDDA. And there's no evidence that the prosecutor had actual notice that the defendant intended to invoke the act until he filed his motion to dismiss in December 2006. And contrary to the defense argument, there's no presumption of notice. It's the prisoner's duty to deliver actual notice if he wants to rely on the substantial compliance doctrine and get away with not going through the superintendent. When we had the hearing on this motion to dismiss on December 19th, the prosecutor didn't object. I've never heard about this. That's true. But presumably, the prosecutor received the motion to dismiss that was filed on December 15th. But prior to that time, how can the prosecutor object to something you don't even know about? I think once we reach the conclusion that there was no actual notice of any UMDDA request until December, the analysis of this case is over. Because yes, after December, there were another 8 months that went by before the defendant pled guilty on the following August, but it's important to recognize that the only UMDDA claim that he ever made, that he ever sought to preserve, was his claim that the trial court had already lost jurisdiction by December 2006. If he's right on that point, he wins his case. If he's wrong on that point, he loses. Because after December 2006, he expressly waived his right to speedy trial numerous times. And in continually preserving this claim on the record, he emphasized each time his only claim was loss of jurisdiction by December 2006. He had no beef with all the subsequent continuances. So even in terms of the defendant's own claim as made in the trial court, events after 2006 were immaterial. And that being so, I think I have to agree that my discussion of implied waiver in my brief and of events after 2006 and my attempt to take on People versus Carr, albeit sincere, I really think that's only academic in this case, because he never complained in the trial court about any delays after December 2006.
But if we conclude that we cannot attribute the delays after December 2006 to the defendant, don't we necessarily then have to conclude that at some point before August 2007, the court lost jurisdiction?
I don't think so, because I think the defendant willingly agreed after that point, I want to continue the case. He made a number of express waivers of his speedy trial right, which I would construe as waivers of any additional claim, UMDDA claim after that date, preserving only his claim that before December 19th came around, I gotcha.
But assume for the sake of argument that we conclude that those waivers did not affect any tolling, any extension of the time, so that the 6 months would necessarily run from actual notice in December. If we reach that conclusion, wouldn't we have to grant relief, even though it's slightly different from the claim that he expressly preserved, which was based on the time that ran before December 2006?
No, I don't think you would have to grant relief. And I'm sorry, I've only got 2 minutes left because there are a lot of things to talk about as far as that goes. One is the point you raised during counsel's argument about it, perhaps in the wake of Carr, we're going to have to look with new eyes at 1614.104, where it says 180 days or such additional time as the court for good cause may grant or for a continuance being granted. And, of course, the other possibility that I've held open to you, and if you feel that you need to reach the People versus Carr issues, I invite you to decline to follow People versus Carr because it's wrong. And among the many things that bug me about Carr, perhaps the most outstanding is its attempt to distinguish or harmonize the other UMDDA cases that were decided after 1995. I think that's a strained and unconvincing attempt. If you look at cases like Garcia, Schreck, Seurat, they all recited this implied waiver doctrine as black letter law. And Carr says, well, Garcia was decided on basis other than the implied waiver rationale, so it doesn't matter. I disagree. I've reread that case a bunch of times, and it seems to me they relied, at least in significant part, on the implied waiver doctrine there. Schreck was decided on an express waiver basis, a handwritten note by the defendant, but there was no full advisement in open court in Schreck, so perhaps Carr would require a different result in Schreck. But in any event, you have these cases at least stating the implied waiver doctrine as black letter law after the 1995 amendment. And I think in the 8 seconds I have left, let me argue that when the legislature amended the statute again in 2004, when it did so, it's deemed to have approved that implied waiver doctrine that had consistently been announced by the courts as black letter law even after the 1995 amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Engel.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to just address a few of those points. The AG cites Campbell and Trancoso for language on substantial compliance. And I just want to point to the language in those cases that says, substantial compliance does not require a prisoner's punctilious compliance with the requirements of the statute. And that, however inartfully pleaded, a pro se complaint must be liberally construed. And I think under this...
Ms. Almaney, giving you the benefit of the doubt here, I say that notice was in fact given on December 19th, 2006, it is accurate, isn't it, that the only thing preserved at that point by Mr. Jess was that he maintained the court had lost jurisdiction prior to that time because of a violation of his UM rewrites?
Well, actually, Mr. Jess also filed motions to, he reasserted his UMDDA rights on December 19th, first of all. So I think that he both preserved it back to May 11th, 2006, but he also reasserted it on December 19th, 2006, so that this court is able to look at two different time periods, that between May and November of 2006 and that of December 2006 through June 2007.
And he did that with his filings on December 19th, 2006?
Yes. And subsequent filings also reasserted that same argument. Also, I don't have the motion for continuance in front of me, but I think that if the court looks back at the record, that motion for continuance did specifically state that the continuance was not beyond the 180-day period. It was still within, even though he was asking for a continuance, it was a short continuance within what he considered to be the 180-day period, even though the court wasn't recognizing that 180-day period.
Which motion are we talking about now?
The motion for continuance, which was filed, I believe, on August 14th, 2006. Yes, August 14th, 2006. He accepted a trial date outside the UN. April 25th, 2007. I believe is the date of that. So I think that that motion for continuance will show that even though the trial court was not recognizing an 180-day period, Mr. Jess was proceeding on the assumption that he was entitled to the 180-day period, and when he asked for a continuance, he asked for it within that 180-day period. And I think we can, going back to that actual notice issue, there's no evidence that the plaintiff or the prosecutor did not receive actual notice in this case. There's simply no statement by the prosecutor at any point that, and especially on December 19th, when the prosecution certainly had an opportunity to say, wait a minute, I didn't receive actual notice of this. That was never argued, and I think that that can be presumed to show that the prosecutor did receive actual notice.
Thank you, Ms. Almaney.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to both counsel. This matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.
All right. Court will be in recess, subject to call.